Good morning, everyone. I'm Judith Avenger, and I'm one of the local Dharma leaders here. Our schedule for today is we will start with a meditation, and then we're going to have a special thing today. Instead of a Dharma talk, we're going to have a little panel discussion. So three of my wonderful co-leaders have graciously agreed to come and talk about their experiences this month with the First Noble Truth, which we will get to later. As we enter this space, let us remember that we are entering a sacred space, a space for being in the moment with whatever is present. We recognize our deep connection with one another, where each of us is welcome just as we are, freeing our minds of greed, hatred, and delusion through this practice offers the opportunity for others to do the same and reduces ignorance and hatred in the world. It is with gratitude we practice together. And I'd like to end by sharing a poem with you. I think I may have shared this before. I'm not sure, but this is a poem I wrote after 9/11, and it is coming to mind a lot these days. It seems to be appropriate for these times as well. Kuan Yin, she who hears the cries of the world. In the time of unspeakable grief, she waits. Not knowing villain or victim, she watches. Her arms open wide, invisible, except for the light which does shine through the dark cloud, the dark dream, the dark night. She listens. Thank you, everyone, for your practice. Okay, so we will move on to our panel discussion this morning. Our teaching focus for the year is the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And in case you missed any of the talks that we've had already this month, Tim's talks on Monday night and here on the Sunday sit, both Lauren and Nana gave us wonderful overviews of the Four Noble Truths. And last week, Arv gave us a very concise and insightful discussion on the First Noble Truth, which is really our focus for this month and for today. The First Noble Truth, which is there is dukkha. Dukkha is part of life. And dukkha is generally translated as suffering. I prefer actually to translate it as all the stuff we don't like, because it really ranges from, you know, the most intense losses and illnesses and accidents and disasters, all the way down to, well, I wanted to do something outside today and it's raining, or somebody said something mean to me, you know, that kind of thing. So a big, big range of just stuff we don't like, right? And one big factor of dukkha is impermanence, the fact that everything is impermanent, because we have a tendency to want to hang on to the things we like and push away the things we don't like. And I think that often, even when things are really good, there is this little shadow of unease, because we know it's not going to last and we don't know what's coming. And then, of course, there is all of the stuff we add to any painful experience through our conditioned reactions. So, a sprained ankle, for example, is not just a sore ankle. It becomes, oh my God, how am I going to do all the things I need to do? Or what if this isn't better in a week and I have to travel? Or how could I have been so stupid, right? I had a sprained ankle last April, so familiar with all of that. And so anyway, that's dukkha. And so I have been really focusing on how to practice with it. How do we practice with dukkha? And I find that my mind tends to go in one of two directions when there's something I don't like. On the one hand, it might become obsessive and just start, making up stuff and going over it over and over and over again and projecting into the future and stuff. And that obviously is not very productive. But if I'm paying attention, that can be an important part of the process because it's a signal. It's a sign I need to deal with this, that here is something I need to address. And then on the other hand, sometimes I just want to push it away. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to think about it. I just want to escape. And that, in its own way, again, if I'm paying attention, can play a role too in the process because I don't know about you, but sometimes my mind just wears me out. And I just need to send it out to pasture for a while and say, okay, lose yourself in a movie, lose yourself in a book for a little while, right? And then I'll come back and I'll get my energy back for the practice. But at some point, you got to come to the middle road, the middle path. Not avoiding, not wallowing in it, but simply opening to whatever is happening, being with it. And as Philip Moffat says, what is the felt sense of this experience? Whether it's physical pain or an emotional pain, what is the felt sense? Oh, this is what the pain in my knee feels like right now. This is what irritation feels like. This is what grief feels like, or fear, or anger. It's like this now. It's like this now. Okay. And sometimes I find that just doing that is enough. There are some things I sit with them like that and they begin to lighten. They begin to let go. Other things are stickier. They're harder. And they take longer. And sometimes they take a really long time, And when that happens, I think there are a couple of things to look out for. One is getting attached to the results of your practice, right? I have sat with this thing 10 times. Why is it still there, right? Because the attachment is only going to increase the dukkha, right? And the other thing, and this is really important, some things are so, they go so deep and they're so hard that you can only take them in little bites sometimes. And sometimes they really are actually reaching the level of trauma. And if that happens, you probably don't want to tackle it alone. There are times when you need help, when you need counselor, therapist, whatever it is. And that is not a failure. It does not mean you're a bad meditator. It means that you are taking care of yourself. So it's really important to remember a little patience and a lot of discernment are really, really important. So that's what I have to say, and I would like to now pass the torch to Lyndall.
Okay, I had to get myself unmuted there. So in a way, I think I'm going to be repeating some of the things that Judith said, but a little slightly different way. And so what's really struck me as I've been thinking about dukkha is that, this is really a task that we're given, to understand dukkha. We really have our work cut out. Even knowing what it means to understand dukkha can be pretty confusing sometimes. And I ran across some comments by Ajahn Sumedho that I'd like to share with you because it really highlights this whole issue. And he says that initially the way we think about the truth of dukkha is, I'm suffering. I don't want to suffer. I meditate and I go on retreats to get out of suffering, but I'm still suffering. And I don't want to suffer. How can I get out of suffering? What can I do to get rid of it? Now, does this sound familiar to anybody? And then he goes on to say, but that is not the first noble truth. It's not, I'm suffering and I want to end it. The insight is, there is suffering. But just to say there is suffering is way too simple, since dukkha involves a whole lot that we might not think about when we think suffering, just as Judith was saying. It's bigger than this idea of, oh, I'm really miserable, because it goes from everything we think of as being really true suffering to that mildest irritation and dissatisfaction, that feeling we don't have quite enough, just like Judith was talking about. And just agreeing in our minds that, yeah, there's suffering. We see that isn't enough either. We have to really get down with it and really know it in our own experience. And there's a lot to get to know. So first we have to understand the fact that painful experience is part of life for everybody. Moment to moment, it's not always going to be pleasant. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. And a lot of that's not in our control. Sometimes we don't get what we want. We lose what we'd like to hold on to. And in the end, even if we had the most perfect life with all the wealth and success and beauty that we could hope for, sooner or later we're going to get old and get sick and die, and then it's going to go. So, those reflections need to be there that we're not immune. And just coming to really accept this is really tough because even though it's obvious that this is true, I know that there's some level where I don't want to believe it. I kind of want to think that somehow this doesn't actually apply to me and somehow I can get out of this. So it's hard. And then in addition to this pain of dukkha, we also have to understand the other two of the three characteristics, anatta, or non-self, and anicca, or impermanence. And, like Judith was saying, these two are a big part of why we can't just get what we want and keep it that way. Nothing really lasts, so we can't hold on to the pleasant things. And even we aren't solid and permanent, so we can't hold on to that ideal self that we try so hard to create. And understanding these things is really tough too, because we don't want to believe them either. Impermanence, we know that's true, but somehow we think that it doesn't necessarily apply to us. Now, anatta or not self, we really don't want to believe, and it's really even kind of hard to comprehend because we want to continue our existence so much. And I think that it can take some pretty dramatic experiences sometimes to actually come to terms with these. Maybe in our meditation practice, maybe in real life when we have a real painful loss of someone we love, to get us to actually know on a deep level that things are really true. So these things are really true. So it's not easy. And then there's just the whole issue of actually working with our own experience of dukkha. in our daily lives, seeing that how there's so much variation between pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, it just doesn't stay the same. And feeling our own pain, the big things, and then those little things of not being ever quite satisfied, which actually is kind of important because it helps us to see that, you know, somehow these conditioned things in this world, no matter how good it is, it's never going to quite satisfy us. And that's sort of hard to understand too. Let's see. And then there's all that we need to get a sense of the difference between the primary pain of something just being simply, well, not just, of something being unpleasant, and then all that extra pain we add because we don't want things to be like this. And, you know, all that stuff, this shouldn't be happening. Why is it happening to me? This is my fault. This is all somebody else's fault. It isn't fair. Blah, 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 blah. We know that dialogue. We know it really, really well. So we need to know about that. And then there's that kind of hidden pain in what's pleasant. And this is harder to see because it's that pain we have when we experience some really nice thing. First, we're just happy. We appreciate it. We're glad it's so nice. And then we start to worry about, okay, how can I hang on to this thing? How can I make it even better? What's going to happen to it? So then all this tension and wanting kind of comes into just our simple enjoyment and appreciation. And that's another kind of pain. So it's pretty overwhelming. It's pretty overwhelming. A little while ago, a few of us teachers had tea with Ajahn Kobalo and Ajahn Nisabo from Clear Mountain Monastery, and we told them how we're going to be studying the Four Noble Truths this year. And Ajahn Nisabo sort of joking said, oh, what's your schedule going to be? 11 months of dukkha and a month for the rest? And, you know, not quite, but it could be that way. Although I think you guys would get really tired of hearing us talk about dukkha for 11 months. But working with it is a lifetime project. And you know, too, I feel like, well, I've been talking about how difficult it is because there's so much resistance in us that we all are going to have to deal with. I mean, it's like with everybody. At the same time, I really feel a lot of joy because all this work is really leading somewhere from suffering to the end of suffering. And it's interesting, too. You know, it is interesting. So even in the midst of all this struggle, there's happiness. So that's what I have to say about dukkha today. Thank you. And I'll turn the baton over to Candace.
Oh. Judith and Lyndall have both kind of given us a broader look, and I'm going to narrow in on a habit I've discovered this month. As Lyndall says, it's a lot to get to know. And sometimes it's easier to see just one little point and how sitting with it can reveal a lot. As Philip Moffat says, our life is entwined and defined by dukkha. But man, you know, these small things can really slip by us. I have this habit called dukkha patrol. That's what I call it. It goes like this. I feel physically and mentally great, calm, happy. And a little voice in my head says, uh-oh, no one's on dukkha patrol. I need to check for trouble. So I do. I don't rest until I find a worry to cloud this happy moment. Why do I do this to myself? A few weeks ago, I fell asleep thinking about this. And this is what was in my head when I woke up. Open the pod bay doors, Hal. I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that. What's the problem? I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do. Now, that illusion is something you're not accustomed to. It's from 2001, A Space Odyssey. And, and Hal is the AI driving the space station. Dave is one of the astronauts and thinks that Hal's been making its own decisions, wants to get in the pod and protect himself from Hal to talk to his colleagues. I wanted the pod for my protection. This Duca patrol is much more than a silly habit. In fact, it's not a patrol at all. It's Duca. I tried to decide which Duca, big S or little s suffering, and decided that's not the insight I need. I took the original question, why I go on Duca patrol in a happy moment, and changed it to, why do I think I should be worrying? And I came up with many reasons. Here's one. I'm somebody when worrying. Being somebody means I need to defend that somebody. So I'm vigilant, on alert. Another reason. I know this moment won't last, so I want to be ready. Why? It won't last, whether or not I do anything. It's guaranteed. So what am I getting out of it? I think I'll control it if I get ahead of it. Here's a third, which is actually a bit of the last one, but more specific. I'm waiting for the shoe to drop. I know it's coming. And this third one, the actual idiom is waiting for the other shoe to drop, was what helped me see what's really going on here, how all of this is creating suffering. It's not protecting me. That original moment was the present moment. The Vedana, her feeling tone of that moment, was pleasant. And I popped out of the moment to the future with a memory of past and thought, uh-oh, I know pleasant moments come and go, and I better steel myself against the unpleasant. Steel myself against it, which means to be mentally and emotionally prepared, unyielding in the face of something difficult. Whoa. Yeah. After all this time, I'm still fighting dukkha. I'm armoring myself against it. I'm trying to avoid the ouch of suffering. Asking Hal to open the pod bay door, I want to step into the armor, the pod, and defend myself against Hal. My own wisdom. I need to sit with this. I recently heard in passing a different translation of the word dukkha, a more literal one, this person claimed, constricted space. And sukha is the release of constriction. Steeling myself, wanting to get in the pod, was definitely heading for dukkha, constricted space. And why? Why do we ever flee something? Fear. Fear that I couldn't bear it. Some of this is a habit developed years ago when recovering from deep depression. But you know, now it's just causing suffering. Philip Moffat says, choosing to bear your suffering takes an act of courage. But once you do, you've initiated the process of inner transformation. That's why I practice inner transformation. Yet I've been fighting it, fearing it, this dukkha patrol. So I set my intention for practice for the rest of the month, at least, to be with my dukkha, to sit with the feelings, feel the judgments, feel the feelings without judgment, without armor. And that includes being in pleasant moments with ease, being in unpleasant or indifferent moments with curiosity. No more calling on Hal to open the pod bay door. That pod is armoring me for battle with my wisdom. No, just be with it all. And I've noticed all manner of knee jerks. I've noticed that moment when my work is difficult and I think about checking social media, what I'm labeling difficult isn't a problem, it's the process. Why interrupt it? I've noticed this quick labeling of something as a problem frequently. And when I realize it and sit with the feelings arising, you know, the worst of them is the shielding. That's the worst part of that feeling. When I step out of that, I'm okay. I can accept the moment. The more I witness how the habit is the source of the suffering, the easier I am with those reactive moments up. I see what's happening, no big deal. They're small things, but I feel buoyed by this exploration. I mean, it's just this one habit, but oh, it's been so rich. Resisting dukkha, steeling myself against it, causes suffering. Releasing that contraction and allowing myself to be vulnerable opens up possibilities. No more dukkha patrol. And I pass the baton over to Seuss.
Wow. Aren't we lucky to have all of us talking Dharma together? And while we met, I didn't really know what I was going to hear from Candace, Lyndall, and Judith, and so grateful. So just, you know, sometimes things just happen right, because I'm going to continue Candace's theme of the ways that we avoid dukkha. So, and I do want to say that we, in fact, are going to be spending 11 months on dukkha, actually 12 months, because it's such an essential piece of being able to then look at our attachments next month and all of the steps of the Eightfold Path. So we're taking this practice with us as we go. So I have a list of 6 ways that I, anyway, have been avoiding dukkha. I don't have a dukkha patrol, but I have my own avoidance. And just as an opening kind of confession, and I said this to Judith, Lyndall, and Candace, that, you know, I've been practicing over 40 years, and I bet the first 20, I really was good at avoiding the dukkha. I figured out all kinds of ways, and as a result, a lot of my understanding was above the eyebrows, not deep down inside. So I want to share my ways, and maybe some of them will kind of resonate with you, and you'll see some of the ways you're avoiding dukkha. The first is believing that our emotions are telling the truth. And yes, in the moment, there is some truth to them. But what we do is we give our emotions way more power and decide that this truth of the moment, this experience of what's up in our hearts and minds and body, is true about me. So for me, fear has been an accompaniment my whole life. And I went from fear is present to I'm a scaredy cat. I'm an afraid person. So taking form in our emotions, that's the first one, that really, instead of fully feeling the fear, I became it. A second one, and this one has to do with my own relationship to metta and metta practice over the years. I used metta as a bypass. Oh, this moment, this is just really hard. I'm just, you know, I'm not liking anything that's going on. Oh, I think I'll do a metta practice. Oh, and you know, and I'll send metta to me, and I'll send metta to these other people, and then everything will be good. Well, that's not really what metta is about. And I think in many ways, that's an inclination anyway that many of us have. A third, after the emotional formation and metta, is I, for whatever reason, am by nature an optimistic person. The cup is not only half full, it's overflowing. And I can look back to my family of origin and see, you know, when you have so many depressed people around, it's not a bad choice to choose something else. But unfortunately, the way this optimism has taken form is in this persona that we call, not so affectionately, Susie Sunshine. Susie Sunshine is not so helpful when things are difficult and you're talking with somebody who's, you know, really feeling some challenges. Me bringing out all this, oh, everything will come out right and yada, yada. A real way of avoiding what's actually going on. Doris Kearns Goodwin, who is this amazing historian, was interviewed about some other stuff, and her quote about optimism is really good. She says, if you're always optimistic, It means you're not really understanding what's going on inside of you. And as we know, just like Sylvia Boorstein's book that says happiness is an inside job, it's all an inside job. And so to understand the dukkha and the sukha and the discernment and the wisdom, we need to really give up some of that inclination of over-optimism. A fourth one is comparing one's suffering to others' suffering. Some of us have been raised in families where a sibling or a parent has pretty severe difficulty. My older sister was born with spina bifida. And it was so easy for me to discount any of my own unhappiness because Nancy was going through all kinds of really hard stuff. But dukkha is dukkha is dukkha. And yours is yours and mine is mine. The fifth one is trying to fix the dukkha. Some of my lovely colleagues talked about that. But really, when I turn a situation into a problem that has to be fixed, what I'm really doing is arguing, resisting whatever is up. In life, there are so many natural laws. I mean, we talk about aging, illness, and death is one of them. But another natural law is that sometimes you get what you want and sometimes you don't. Disappointment is just as natural as aging. And to turn it into a problem that I have to fix, instead, how about if I just sit with what disappointment feels in the body? And the last one that I use or used to use a lot for avoiding dukkha was setting up an expectation and a standard for what it means to be a good Buddhist meditator. And this mind would say, well, if I was really a good Buddhist, if my practice was really serious, then I'd be beyond this. One of my other colleagues said something like, well, haven't I just dealt with this for years and years and years? How come I'm not past it? Well, you're not past it because you're not ready to be past it, you know? And instead of really experiencing what's going on, I was tamping down my the actual experience. So in the end, what all of us have been saying is that dukkha is actually, now this may sound like it's coming from Susie Sunshine, but I think it isn't. I think dukkha is an invitation. It's an invitation to explore the full experience of our lives and learn from it. Not push it away, not tamp it down, not try to explain it away, not try to fix it or compare it or be on dukkha patrol or all the things that we've talked about, but to learn from it, to feel the ouch of it, and in the end, to know what you know about dukkha. Thank you. Didn't do too bad, the four of us. We only had 6 minutes, but we took a little longer. Thanks for your attention to all of us.
And thank you all for your contributions. It was wonderful to see all these different perspectives. I love it. Just a little bit about breakout group etiquette. Make sure everybody has a chance to talk. When someone else is talking, your job is just to pay attention and listen, not to think about what you're going to say, not to offer advice, just be there and listen. Okay, I think everybody is back. So we have a few minutes for any comments or questions that you might have. And also, if you have specific questions that you want to address to Suze or Lyndall or Candace, you could do that also if there's anything you wanted to talk to them about. And Nana.
Thank you very much, Judith, for your really touching talk and hear from Lyndall and Suze as well. You know, anytime dukkha is present, I share this in the small group, is proof that awakening is nearby.
I like that. I was thinking about what Steve was saying yesterday, to see every person as a potential Buddha, essentially.
Remember, the third noble truth is the possibility of the end of dukkha. And we practice the first and second, you know, of dukkha and the attachment and understanding what the mind does, so that we have those moments of freedom. So thank you, Nana, for that. And I just want to put in a plug. If you go onto the SIMS website and look at the talk library, in 2016, Christina Feldman did a whole weekend on the Four Noble Truths and Nibbana. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we Westerners don't talk about Nibbana very much. I guess we will come March. But anyway, it is a fabulous resource to listen to. And she's a great teacher. Just throwing that in. 2016.
Great. Thank you. There's a lot on that page, that talks page. It's amazing number of resources. Yes. Ira?
Yeah. We talked a little in our group, which was lovely. But I was saying that it's there's dukkha, which of our existence, impermanence, aging, pain, illness. And then there's the dukkha that we add by reacting and resisting. And so I get confused in these, you know, or people are using dukkha and I'm not sure which one they're talking about. People are just saying dukkha.
Right.
So I feel like there's not that refined distinction between what people are meaning. And I think people mean different things. So I don't know if others get confused by that, when people are just talking.
Yeah, I think one thing that, Steve, again, yesterday was saying there's pain and then there's suffering. And the suffering is what we add to the pain that turns it into suffering. And the dukkha is really, it is a little unclear sometimes, because pain is going to happen, right? Stuff's going to happen that hurts. But how we react to it is what makes the difference.
Well, I understand that too, but I feel like if people just use the term dukkha,
right,
they're not saying which one they're meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that the discussion, or sometimes the talks, can be confusing, because I'm not sure which what the person's intention is when they're speaking. It gets thrown into a bag with a word that's in another language.
Right. Yeah.
Can I respond to Ira's question? Because I think that Ira, I'm on a different place than you are around receiving these talks on dukkha. I like that the word is used over and over again, because for me, it's an invitation to dig in and discern what they're meaning. And Arv's talk last week, when he described the, you know, big S and little S, and Tim's talks about optional and non-optional, I think they're an invitation for each of us to look at, well, which one am I doing? So, and using dukkha, because it's defined so many different ways in English, I think it gives me, anyway, a freedom to explore, because I'm just using the Pali word. So just a different perspective for how you're dealing with that, and hopefully it's helpful.
Yes, I agree. So, Jerry, did you had your hand up before anybody else did. Did you want to say something about that? And then we'll go to Thomas.
Just repetitive. Julie also mentioned, and the reference to Arv's talk makes some nice distinctions around the types of dukkha. I just prefer, yeah, it's a good one to lay out the territory. That's all.
And Thomas, what did you?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Judy. I first want to express some appreciation for the panel format. I think it was really helpful for me to listen to, you know, our teachers' different ways of living and practicing with dukkha. I mean, it's just the individual approaches to it, I think, made it very rich, and there was a lot of ideas for me to pick up there. So really thank you for that. And that panel sort of continued into our small group. It was kind of a little mini panel. So we actually also explored in my group, you know, three different ways of approaching and working the different aspects of dukkha. So that was really great. I think for me, the clarity here, which probably is somewhat obvious, is that dukkha is just a part of your life. It's a factor that you, and there's opportunity in learning to accept that it is here, that it's a lot of, when you look at the advertisement that's around you, it seems like if you just buy the right things or make the right moves in life, you can sort of be happy all the time. But I mean, I think we all know here that it doesn't quite work that way. So how do you find your way to work with dukkha and find some ways to reduce suffering and find happiness? I think this session has brought a lot of richness to how can you do that. And some ideas for me I can pick. So thank you very much for setting it up this way.
And I just want to say to Ira, we spent the Sunday morning teachers spent quite a long time discussing what dukkha is and trying to define it and distinguish between the different types of it. So it's not exactly an easy topic, but I think someone mentioned Arv's talk. Oh yeah, Jerry mentioned Arv's talk last Sunday. I don't know if you saw that or not, but it would be a good one to review because he really went into that in quite some detail, and it should be on the talks page.
It takes a few weeks to get it up on the website. There's a lot of steps, so it may not be there yet, but keep checking.
It will be, yeah, it will be. So we have come to the end here. So I just very briefly would like to dedicate the merit of our practice today to all beings. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. And thank you very much for your attendance, your attention, and your practice.